Ladies and gents, welcome back to the Inspiration Space for an absolute banger that we have for you today. James Haskell was one of the names that I had on the original list of people I wanted to get on this show one day. Back when I was putting the Inspiration Space fabric together back in 2015, 2016, it was a bit of a pipe dream. So this one was really, really special for me that I got him to come on the show and have a chat, and I really enjoyed every single second of this one. James was somebody I've obviously followed his whole career, all the way from Wasps, all the way through to his last game with Northampton, and obviously every single game for England. I never miss an England game, so it was a real pleasure to watch him throughout his career. He approached every game with such intensity and competitiveness, and you could just see the impact he had on his fellow players. He's such a fun and charismatic guy. You could really see the impact he had on them. Obviously, James has got super stuck in his post-rugby career. He's involved with some amazing projects such as, you know, MMA. Loads of the charity work that he does is pretty, pretty special. And obviously, the podcast that he does, House of Rugby, is one of the most followed, I think, most probably in the world now. And yeah, I listen to that every week. James is a real character. Guys, you'll really, really enjoy this one. So yeah, get stuck into it. Don't hold back. It's a real banger. And you can just see from second one how engaging he really is.
James, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know how busy you are. I've been really looking forward to this one. Obviously, of all the people I've probably had on the show, I've had to do the least amount of research on you because I've followed your career forever. But yeah, I just want to say thanks so much. And I think probably for everyone, loads of people who's listening today will know who you are, but probably just a bit of background on yourself, kind of how you got into, you know, the world of rugby, and probably, yeah, a bit about your early days probably is best to start.
Well, look, it's my pleasure to come on. You know, I'm a big fan of you and Tristan. I think you guys did an amazing job in, you know, F45 Oxford Circus, and obviously a new Soho setup. I used to be a professional rugby player from kind of the age of 16 to 35. I retired a year ago. I played for Wasps, Northampton Saints, Stade Français in Paris, the Highlanders in New Zealand, the Ricoh Black Rams in Japan. I played the Lions. I played 77 times for England. And I was in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. I signed a three-fight deal in Bellator to fight. I was supposed to have my first fight on the 16th of May, but that unfortunately got fucked by COVID. I am a professional DJ. That's my favourite hobby. That's my number one thing. I've got a radio show called Back Row Radio. House of Rugby, yeah, we had a podcast with House of Rugby. This is like a talk me up a thon, but I don't mean to be. But and we had our 16th million download the other day. So that's gone quite mega. And I've just released, well, my autobiography is coming out on October the 1st, called What a Flanker. Basically, play on What a Wanker, because I guarantee that probably 80% of the people who listen to your podcast will think I'm a prick. And, you know, 20% will quite like me. And most people don't like me before they met me. And, you know, probably the same amount don't like me after they met me. So,
mate, you've gone straight through the whole spectrum there. You are super, super busy, man. I want to start at the very beginning, though. I mean, I remember when you first came onto the scene with Wasps. And it was back in the day. Did you come on the same time around as Cipriani? Was he a little bit...
No, so Cipri... he is, how old is he? I think he's like maybe 4 years younger than me, maybe 5 years younger than me.
Is he?
I can't remember for sure. Yeah, 5 years younger than he is. So he was actually came in. So when I was, when I must have been sort of 20, 21 or 22, he was just starting out at the academy, him and a guy called Don Waldock, Duke. For those of you who know him, very good looking man. Jack Waldock, Don Waldock, Jackie Duke.
I think Don Waldock got my sister once actually out.
Oh, hey, mate. Listen, Dom is unbelievably clever, incredibly good looking, but also one of the biggest space cadets ever. It's like that the house could be on fire around him, and I don't think he'd notice. But he's very clever, but he's a lovely guy. So yeah, Dom and Sippy came through at the same time. But I was older. My generation was Tom Rees, who sadly retired. Tom Evans. Trying to think who else sort of in the Premier. Paul Doran Jones, obviously my best mate. You know, those, that kind of crew.
Yeah, but still, when you came onto the scene, it was like the Delalios of this and the Vickeries were still there, weren't they? I mean, that was a hell of a Wasps team to come into. What was that like coming into that team with so many, you know, a couple of World Cup winners? And what was the... And it was still kind of like, even though it wasn't the amateur days. There were still players that had been in the amateur days. So what was that club format like? Was there still elements of the amateur scene a little bit?
Yeah. Look, I think I was very spoilt by going to Wasp. I think that if I'd gone to Leicester, I wouldn't be here now as a professional rugby player. And I may or may not have topped myself. Obviously, it's not normally a laughing matter, but the Leicester boys don't necessarily embrace, you know, kind of that difference of personality. At Wasp, you know, I was really lucky. You know, Delalio, Josh Lucy, Simon Shaw, Alex King, you know, Phil Vickery, Mark Denny, Rafael Ibanez, Josh Lucy, Richard Burkett, you know, like Johnny O'Connor, just boys, just, you know, Rob Howley, Matt Dawson, like everybody was there. And we sort of won everything for a long period of time, which was amazing. And I was very spoiled because they encouraged personality over anything. You know, they wanted you to train hard. So we trained harder than anyone. They were the first team that embraced strength and conditioning. And it came off the back of, we used to play something called the Middlesex Sevens, which was a great day out. And one year they invited Bradford Bulls to put a Sevens team in. Wigan to put a Sevens team in. And they had Sean Edwards. Andy Farrell, Martin O'Fire, Henry Paul. And they absolutely dicked everybody in the Premiership. And basically off the back of that, Warren Gatland and Sean Edwards reached out to a guy called Craig White, who was a guru, and basically said, look, rugby needs to get into the 20th century and 21st century, whatever the fuck it is, and get it sorted. And he basically brought in training. We had periodized training. They started to bring in, specific weight programs for people, conditioning. And basically the motto was, you know, to be as big and fit as anyone and just beat the fuck out of everyone in defence. And that's why you had Sean Edwards. So we caught sort of spoiled, but we had lots of stories, you know, lots of personality. We trained hard, but we parted very hard off the field as well when it was the right time.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I can imagine being around, like, I mean, just pick one character out that's always fascinated me. I read his book years ago, Delalio. I mean, being around that, I mean, you turned into a massive leadership figure within the England group, and we'll talk about that later as your career went on. What did you pick up, you know, things from Lawrence Delalio of how to lead from the front? I mean, what kind of things did he kind of teach you to look at the game and to look at how to treat people around you within the team?
Yeah, look, I think Lawrence is pretty an inspirational guy. You know, people have compared me to him a lot in my career, like, you know, long Lawrence Delalio, next Lawrence Delalio. Look, I never lived up to that hype. You know, Lawrence was a player, set aside from other people. You know, he won World Cups, he won Premierships. You know, he was known for his bravado, known for his hard work, for his leadership. He's very articulate, you know, sort of Churchillian speeches and everything else. I think for me, he was someone that inspired people by his presence. He inspired people by his oratory skills. He you know, was able to, to be great on the field, but also party the fuck, you know, the hell out of it off the field. And I really enjoyed it. I think, I always had my utmost respect for him. I think what I learned about him was making sure that you if you talk the talk, you walk the walk as well. And that, you know, but I also learned more from other captains as well, like differentials, you know, like working with guys like Dylan Hartley and some other people, you know, you don't always need to have all the words to say. Lawrence was lucky. You know, he had the words at the right time, at the right place, and was able to back it up and had the bravado, you know, the big chin, the fucking big chest, you know, the big pre-match sniff where he'd be like, fucking hell, lads. It's going to be like a street fight without any rules. Bring your tools. Let's get barred up. You know, he had that. But, yeah. You know, you've got other people who might just lead from the front, or people who know, put an arm around it. Or someone like Dylan was amazing because he worked extremely hard, but he also knew how to get those around him to help take the reins. You know, so I believe I'm quite good at speaking and motivating, understanding the team dynamics, you know, but I played in a physical way. So I tried to back that up. Other people have more nuanced understanding of like the technical side. So, you know, it's not just one man, but I think with Lawrence, he was very unique. I mean, obviously he's had his few run-ins as we all have in the media, but I think he was probably one of the first rugby players that crossed over between, you know, rugby player and celebrity in some respects.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I always found about your career that which I had a huge admiration for was that you were kind of one of the first to go and travel around the different countries. And obviously you had that mad early success with Wasp, but then you obviously moved into Stade Francais. You then went to Japan. You went to the Highlanders in Down Under. Do you think, in what capacity do you think that really improved you as a player? I mean, did you do that to simply grow your expertise and understanding of the game? Was that the intention from going travelling around the world?
So look, I was very spoiled with WASC. You know, I was there for 5 years, first time round, 6 years, second time round, and I never wanted to leave Wasps. I was established. I was playing in England. Wasp was always someone that had terrible training. Wasps as a team had terrible training facilities, underpaid you, but because you won everything, you knew that. So we got players from other teams who would get paid more, but came here to guarantee, competing for a Premiership or a Heineken title, which was great. However, when Wasp stopped winning stuff and they didn't invest in the squad, I took 2.5 years to try and negotiate a contract. I was the lowest paid England player in the England side for a long time. And I wanted to get what was right. So, there's a certain clause in the contract after sort of 1st December or whenever it is, you can start talking to other people. And I'd always wanted to go and play things like Super 15 and play in France. You know, as a player, we always talked about those big Heineken Cup weekends, playing against Toulouse, playing against Toulon, playing against Castres, playing against Stade Français. You know, these are the games that everybody lives for in these big finals. So I thought, going to Stade Français, when I realised what they were going to pay me, the quality of players I was going to play with and the big matches I was going to have, I knew it was going to develop me as a player. Mentally, it was going to toughen me up. I was going to be going out of my comfort zone completely. No friends, no family, into a country that I didn't speak the language, into a tough team environment. Fully criticised by everybody. Everybody said that my career was over, that if you leave WASC, you're never going to make it. Lawrence put the boot in. All these rugby journalists kept the boot in. So it was an opportunity for me to kind of broaden my horizons and develop myself. And I went there and I got to play with Sergio Parise and Julien Depuy and Dimitris Tarzeski and all these kind of really special, Pierre Rabadan, these sort of special players. And it taught me to be a lot more self-reliant and self-resilient. It taught me to that actually rugby was rugby wherever you go, and that if you have confidence, if you back yourself, that you could achieve anything. It taught me that even though the eyes of the world, even when, for example, when I went to Japan, weren't on me, I wasn't one of these people that sit back. I can't take things at half pace. I can't be part of a team that isn't going to compete. It doesn't matter how much money you get paid. If you're getting shit kicked out of you every week and you're losing, it's not a great place to be. Where some guys can do that. Some players could take, a million quid, and go and get fucking beaten and not care. I couldn't do that, So I had some I also had some amazing adventures, met some incredible people. And now I can safely say that, I've got friends and people in every sort of team in the world, and kind of left no box unturned, or no box unticked, apart from playing in the whatever the hell, the Pro 14 or whatever it's called. But who the fuck wants to play in that? It was rained every 5 minutes.
That's true. End up in the middle of like Connacht or somewhere like that. It would be nasty. Yeah, fascinating. I mean, playing all over the world, it must have been a great experience. To be honest, I've never really supported a provincial team. England's always been, the only team in any sport that I've been completely obsessed with. I've absolutely followed everything they do every single time they have a game. It's a huge, huge moment. So for me, your England career was, really, really special. And it obviously started with your first game at the Millennium Stadium. That's correct, right?
Yeah,
but what I didn't know actually, one thing I did come across when I was doing a bit of research actually, you played. Did you play for Wales Schoolboys?
Yeah, no.
You can't keep that quiet.
I mean, look, it's interesting. When you're professional at anything. So when I meet fans all the time, and you can't, not fans of me, but rugby fans, and they sort of hover around, and you can see them nervously wanting to talk to you, and you sort of say hello, and they go, oh, sorry, I'm a Leicester Tigers supporter, right? As if I'm going to turn around and go, oh, well, go away. Yeah, go away. What fans can't understand is that they really care about their team and they're tribal about their team. I don't like losing. I like good people, and I like people who are respectful. That's an extension of where my levels of care and interest. So when people say that, I like Leicester Tigers, I like Saracens, I've got mates in all these places, I don't give a shit. Did I want to beat both of them? Yes. Was it nightmarish when you lost to these teams? Yes. Did I care and hate them? No. So it's very funny when fans get like that. And it's the same thing with the national team. Yeah. Whenever we played, when you play, Wales, people go, oh, the Welsh hate you. Look, everybody hates the English. Every fucker in the world hates the English because of, you know, 500 years of empire building. We used to run the world, whatever anyone says, you know, we used to run the world. We've done some bad things in some bad places and whatever. And everybody hates that. Also, you know, the Celtic nations and your France, your Italy's, everyone else, that they have their identity. You know, if you try to be nationalistic as an English person, you know, you carry a St. George's flag, you're suddenly a leader of the BNP or the EDL. That's been everything that's good about our country has been stolen by skinheads, morons and racists. So it's very difficult to go, come on, England, like St. George's Day is something that just happens. You know, where, you know, St. David's Day or Paddy's Day, everyone goes fucking mad. We don't have any of that. So it's the same thing when I played for, you know, I got opportunities. My mum's Welsh. Well, yeah, my mum's Welsh and I'm Welsh qualified. I'm Scottish. I'm actually Irish qualified, Scottish qualified and English qualified. I could have played for all of them. And I basically decided to hedge my bets at under 18 level and do both. So I did Welsh exiles, do everything. And I got to basically... Before, so I did final trials for both teams, and then in about a month's time, they were going to meet up and play each other. And basically, I had to decide, because I was named in the squad for Wales, and I was named in the squad for England. And I had to make a decision. What was I going to do? And I basically called up the Welsh guy and said, listen, I'm going to go with England. And he was like, I don't understand, boy. What do you mean? And I was like, I said, I'm going to go with England. He goes, but you're fucking... But he's like, mate, you're fucking, you're Welsh boy. I fucking, we paid your expenses. And I was like, no, sorry. I'm not going to go with England. And yeah, he's like, I fucking can't believe it, James. I'm honestly devastated, bud. And that was it. I put the phone down. And my name is Mud around that area. But actually, also, I think people forget as well. I didn't want to be a rugby player. I never, so kids now with like, social media, you know, access to sport all the time, all that kind of content. You know, they're picking kids up earlier. Mate, my childhood was spent oblivious to the world, running around, dressed as an army bloke, riding a mountain bike, trying to light fires, you know, have little picnics, fucking doing anything that was going on. I didn't pay any attention. So when I turned up to Wellington and kids were wearing like shirts of their teams and taking things really seriously. And mate, I watched the first professional game rugby, I think I watched when I was like 15. Yeah, I was never that arsed about it. So, you know, I played all sports, did like, you know, I even represented the school chess team, one game, one win. You're welcome. I did theatre, I did everything. So I was always the person to do everything, but I didn't care about it. I just didn't really look into depth about anything. And
how did you land into that well, sort of journey?
I started off playing rugby at Maidenhead Rugby Club when I was five. My mum lied about my age and got me into to playing rugby. And basically, she found out, because back in the day, most of your listeners won't know this, but in pubs in England, you couldn't drink on a Sunday. So rugby clubs, you could have a pint. So my dad discovered that you'd go to a pint. My mum would get my brother and I out of her hair. She'd do whatever she was going to do. Maybe have a little mystery visitor. Who knows? And I would... I love that. Let's go. That's your mum, you mug it off. I was like, all right. Don't ever let anything get in the way of a good joke. So we used to go to rugby club. And I played from there till 18. Loved it. But it was only when I started going to Wellington that they put me in the back row. I started playing... rugby a bit seriously. Then I trialled for England under 16s. And it was basically the fact that I didn't get into England under 16s. I got all the way to the final trial. I basically didn't do any of the extra training I was supposed to do. Didn't do any of the weights. Was trying to chase girls. Was doing whatever. That I found it really disappointing. And basically when the selector called me up and was like, look, you haven't got in. You know, we don't think you played the best. It was devastating. So when you're 15, I was like, I think I cried like a baby. And you know, my dad called me up and he said, look, you can either see this as like a real disappointment play rugby for a bit of fun, or you can come back, next year and a half, stick two fingers up to people and fucking go and get on and do it. And to be honest with you, I had a mate who was a part of the family, a guy called Henry, who was a personal trainer. And he basically used to come twice a week to school every week, in sometimes 3-4 times a week, running up hills, lifting weights. And I basically went from 15 to 16, put on like 10 kgs, was like, you know, just started eating properly, doing everything. And then I got into England under 18s. And the point was that it showed me that if you work hard, dedicated, focused, commit to something, work smart, you can achieve stuff, which has then meant those early lessons that most people don't have has carried me on to the rest of my life. So I always now you know, seek out the best people to work with, you know, work my ass off. I'm a workaholic, look to develop my game. And it was a great early lesson and helped me be successful. And because I got into it, I then got an opportunity to do England under-19s. As soon as you're on under-19s radar, WASPs come a-calling. WASPs, who I supported actually from sort of age, you know, 15 or whatever it is, 40, 50, whenever I watched my first live game. I was a fan of them. I actually started caring about sport. I started watching it because all my mates were watching it. My dad, we started being like season ticket holders. They offered me a contract. I said, you know what? I'll defer my university entry for 1 year to give it a go. And essentially, you know, fucking however many years, 19 and a half seasons later, I was still doing it. And once you get a taste of it, you're like, oh, actually, it's quite good. When I get a taste for England, you're like, this is addictive. I want to do it.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what I'm really interested. What was it? You went through all of that. You got a thirst for it. You worked hard to get to where you wanted to be. You then arrived at getting that England cap. What was it? It must have been so amazing, like landing, getting that white jersey and putting it on and running out for the England squad. What was that like? That's something I've always thought about.
Yeah, it was incredible, but it was interesting. It wasn't quite the so when people think you get called up for England, they think there's going to be like a fanfare, maybe a golden chariot might appear, and the England coach will be like, you know, welcome, you know, you've been selected for England. Now, there's more of these kind
Who
of things.
Who was the coach at the time?
Brian Ashton,
yeah.
Okay. So there's more of this, more detail of this in my book about all this kind of stuff. But essentially, I was driving out of WASPs. I was 21, and Tom Palmer leant out the window, second row for WASPs and for Stafford and Say with me. And he leant out and said, "Oi, dickhead." I was like, "Yeah?" And he goes, I think you're in the England squad for this week. So I was like, what? Right. So I went home and he goes, check your email. So I went home and my email at the time was like something ridiculous, like topshagger@hotmail.com. Something stupid. You know, like you all had those shit email addresses.
Yeah.
Mine was like topshagger@hotmail.com. I mean, the fact that it came true is not, I can't, you know, it's not my fault. So I had this shit email address that I never checked, right? I don't think. Not even my mum would bring herself to write to like topshagger@hotmail.com at like age 17, 21. So I got home and there was an email and it just said, Dear lads, and there was everybody's email addresses. And lo and behold, at the bottom, topshagger@hotmail.com.
Wow.
Was there. And it basically said, meet up in Bath. No one called me. Brian Ashton never called me. No one called me. And it just said, meet up in Bath on a Sunday evening. And what you used to do is you turn up on a Sunday, train Monday, train Tuesday afternoon, and then you get a tap on your shoulder at lunchtime on Tuesday to say whether you're in the team or not. You train Tuesday afternoon, and then you go home on a Wednesday if you're not selected. If not, you'd have a day off on a Wednesday, train Thursday, Friday, play Saturday. So I drove down to Bath in my nan's Vauxhall Astra that, like, you know, was like fucking rumbling, like, down to Bath. And I turned up, and Brian Ashton was there to meet me. And he comes over to me and he says, James, it's really good to have you on board. Really excited about this this next week with you. We haven't decided the team, so we need a really big training session for you tomorrow and Tuesday, and we'll let you know Tuesday. Yeah, good luck. Get collect your kit and go in. So anyway, I walked into reception with my personal bag. Went up and I said hi, and reception says name, and I said James Haskell. She went up and she put it in. She went, all right. She went, just staying the two nights, is it? And I was like, I was like, what? I was like, what? She went, nah, it says you're checking out Tuesday. And I was like, are you fucking serious? So much for the fact they hadn't made their mind up on the team. I learned from the receptionist on the first evening that I wasn't going to be here.
Unreal.
For the next, and then it was the following week that I then got called back in again, and Nick Easter got injured, and I got to play, against Wales.
Superb. And like running out on that pitch, how was that first performance? Were the goosebumps? Were you nervous? Were you shitting yourself? What was the vibe? Well, or did you not give a fuck? You just went out and just did it.
So look, you know, obviously there's always an element of fear,
yeah.
But the fear of the unknown, but you obviously don't know the unknown. Oh, yeah. So you've got no reference points.
Yeah.
You know, we went down, I was excited first and foremost. There was obviously a bit of hype in the papers, you know, hype about, you know, the next Lawrence Dallaglio, blah, blah, blah. You know, we were starting an all WASP back row for the first time ever that a club had played all back rows. It was me, Joe Worsley, and Tom Rees. I was playing six, Tom Rees was playing seven, Joe Worsley was playing eight. I talked about the fact that you know, the Welsh are very passionate. That's what I love about them. You know, I actually love these countries, like envious of how passionate they are and everything else. So we're driving from our hotel through the centre of Cardiff. Now, I had no experience of international rugby. You know, football is tribal. Football is so aggressive. You know, they used to have the intercity firms. They used to fight. They don't have that in rugby. Yes, you have a few flare-ups every now and then, but it's pretty, you know, quite barber brigade. No one's getting filled in, really. And so as we're driving through Cardiff town centre, it's like opening sales on Primark. The fucking place is rank, right? And people are throwing shit at the bus. People are swearing. People are giving it the wanker sign. And I remember in the sea of like people, I saw this elderly lady, right? And she was like waving, like small and cute. So I thought, you know what? It's my first game. The bus didn't have tinted windows then. So I thought, you know what? I'd give it a smile. And I waved to her like that. And she just went and gave it a finger back. And then as we're driving into the stadium, a bloke stepped out from the barrier and headbutted the front of the bus. I was like, fucking come on, well, headbutted the bus, split his head open, and then was bundled over the security gate. So when we, that was obviously, I was like, fucking hell, if this is what it's like outside the ground, what's it gonna be like in there? And so when I went into the change room, I got my England shirt, no one presented it to me, I took it and I had it, and I looked at it and I was like, this is fucking amazing. My name embroidered at the bottom, and you know, it's amazing. I put my music on and I basically went out, warmed up, and they'd left the roof on in the stadium, which is a big mistake because the sound, they're so close to the field at the Principality now, Millennium then, and the roof captures so much noise that when you went out there, it was like dazzling, you know. And also in Wales, they love a sing song. So you've got a fucking 20,000 man choir singing. You've got a brass band that are on our side of the field. Right, the Welsh have got, if anything, they've probably got too much space to warm up in. On our side, there's like brass bands, like, right, marching all across us, so you can only train a certain part. They've then got this goat, they have this like massive, like goat mascot, which is like it's like an absolute roid of goat. It's like the size of me, fucking huge horns up there. It's walking around, you're trying to find a space to warm up, it's carnage. And then you go into Chet Stadium, have your team talk, walk down, and you walk out, all the flame cannons go off. And the noise is like deafening. Mental. And you basically, I just couldn't stop smiling. So I was like, am I going to shit myself? Am I going to cry? And I was like, I could not stop smiling. I was like, hairs on the back of my arms went up, hairs on the back of my head went up. And I was like, this is why I play rugby. This is what I want to do. This is where I want to be. And then most people say when they support a team or the crowd, the 16th man, all that shit. Listen, if you go to Twickenham, it's too corporate. No one says anything apart from Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And now we can't sing that for obvious reasons. So we don't have a song. Most, you know, teams have got a song. When you go to Wales and they've let you close the roof and you're 5 points behind and you're 5 metres from their line, it is honestly like someone is punching you in the face and head because of the sound. It was the most incredible sound I've ever, ever experienced. And the roars, like I can still hear them in my head today. So it was amazing, amazing baptism of fire. And Joe Worsley got knocked out after 38 seconds. So I then played number 8 for the whole game. Actually went well. And, you know, we lost. And that was sort of, that was the last game of the Six Nations. Then we had I had one warm-up game for the World Cup against France. Didn't get picked. They went with Lewis Moody, Nick Easter and somebody else. And then I wasn't seen again until, who was coach next? I think...
Robinson?
No, it was Martin Johnson next. Martin Johnson, yeah.
So, yeah, you had 77 caps. You won 3 Six Nations, 1 Grand Slam. And I believe you did. You won 2 World Cups, right? 2 World Cups?
Yeah. They broke the toilet.
So you don't want to touch on those. What I do want to talk about is that sort of latter part of your career where you really just went up like 10 notches. I'll ask you a question later. I mean, what you think your favourite performance was of your career. But I remember when you went to Australia with Eddie Jones and you had that one performance. I can't remember where it was in Australia, but you were just like on fire. Like I remember you just kicking the shit out of Pocock without that hit in midfield. Where was that in Australia? Which one was that?
I don't remember, mate. I don't know.
No, it was unreal. It was just, honestly, I've never been so pumped up in a game. Like, because that was when England were just on absolute fire. I think you probably just won the Grand Slam, or it might have been just before you won the Grand Slam. Talk us through that.
Post Grand Slam.
All right, okay. So talk us through firstly that Grand Slam. That was when Eddie Jones had just come in. Obviously, off the back of Lancaster's reign, where everyone was so amped up for that team because they thought they had all the minerals. But unfortunately, they didn't get through the group stages, which was a huge disappointment. And then Eddie comes in. I know you had a good relationship with Eddie, and he speaks very highly of you. So talk us through a little bit about that change in transition. What was the change in dynamic moving forward with that England team?
So I think, look, you know, I had a lot of respect for Stuart Lancaster. I think he was incredibly hardworking, probably one of the most hardworking people I know. He obviously inherited a real shit show of an England side that needed to be re-educated in the eyes of the public in terms of what it meant to play for England after 2011, how to behave, how to do everything. And, you know, he did that brilliantly. I think he was much too focused on the task instead of the people, and which is a fine line of management. I think that he tried to adopt a management plan from a guy called Bill Welch from San Francisco 49ers, and basically do everything like he did it in terms of England, and it worked to a certain degree, but actually it didn't work because you didn't have the strength of character, he didn't develop stuff. And actually, interesting, Bill Walsh later in his book has to calls up all the players before he dies that he looked after, even though they won 4 Super Bowls and whatever, and apologise for them. So, you know, which is, you know, because of the way he treated them, because it was such a harsh, draconian environment. So I think there's some interesting elements to take out of that. But I think Stuart was, because, you know, it wasn't a success because he didn't have the characters of players. He didn't have the right selection. He didn't have the balance between being task folks and people folks. Eddie came in, you know, 6 months later with essentially the same team and won a Grand Slam. And he did that because he created a winning environment by making it very challenging. He was very honest and open. He let the boys be boys. He encouraged fun. He was very task focused, but also very people focused. He had some brilliant coaches around him. It was kind of the perfect storm. Steve Borthwick, Paul Gustard, and Dylan Hartley as captain, Neil Hatley, they all worked really well together, created something very special. And, you know, the recipe of success for me and why I played so well, and, you know, I only played 2 games on that tour because I fucked my foot, but I think they're probably 2 of the best games I played for England, because I felt valued. You know, every other England coach, you know, couldn't comprehend why I could be a larger than life personality, do all the stuff off the field, but also as professional dedicated as I was on the field. I think Eddie called me up a week before he came into camp. It's like, mate, I need you. I need you to be responsible. You're a big man for what we need to do. And he treated me like an adult, and I felt loved, and I felt loved ever since by him. And that's all I needed. And that's the difference between getting the best out of me and the worst out of me. Instead of treating me like a naughty schoolboy or someone to be feared or someone to be, so just treat me with respect and value. And I was a confidence player, and I needed confidence. And you know, it was no mistake that he got the best out of his team by doing that. You know, he was harsh on some people, but he was also brilliant. And he did something for the first time in my entire career. England was the squad that you wanted to be part of, and you loved. You know, most people think that being in England, you have the best coaches, best players, and it's the best environment. Some of the shittest environments out of all the environments I've ever been with have been with England.
That's so interesting. I mean, that shows you how important man management is, right? Like, that's like, you obviously knew how to get the most out of each person individually, and having those great coaches around him to kind of maybe take the burden. Did they take the burden off him a little bit to look at, and he just focused on the people essentially? Is that what you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, what people forget is that being an England coach is not just about coaching. It's dealing with the media. We have the worst media in the world. Everybody wants you to fail. You know, build you up, fuck you over. Everyone wants to ask stupid questions and derail you. You know, you have so much other bits and pieces, internal politics. But because of what happened with Stuart, Eddie basically came in and was like the most un-RFU man ever. He did everything his own way. Training things, cleared out, built his coaches. Steve Borthwick, you know, developed into a world-class coach. You know, he was incredible. He worked with Eddie for a long time. Nobody worked harder than Steve Borthwick. There's no man in world rugby that would put up with what he put up with and how Eddie pushed him. That's why he's so good. You know, Paul Gustard was incredible. He was the emotional energy to Eddie's, you know, humour, to Steve Borthwick's directness, and they all created a great place. And Eddie understood what it took to be a player. And when Eddie Jones stands at the front and says, you know, we're going to go from 8th, you know, was it, I think we were 8th in the world or 5th in the world or something. No, I think we're 8th in the world at that point, you know, and to get to number 1 in the world. And he's taken Australia to World Cup final in 2003 and he lost it. He's taken South Africa to World Cup final and won it. And he says, you've got to do that shit. You believe him because he's got integrity, he's got credibility, and he's got, you know, that way of delivering it. And, you know, he constantly wanted to make you better. So, you know, a lot of people in business and management, they turn up on first day, they get a flip chart out, they write on the flip chart all the values, right? And they talk about them on week 2. By fucking 6 months in, that flip chart, no one's gone back to that. So being excellent is a consistent daily task. But the person at the top has to keep driving those standards, and you have to give the players the tools to do it, but also the players have to be accountable to themselves to do it. And Eddie put his hand up, you know, at the first point of his in his thing, and went, who out of these players do you think is self-reliant? I.e., you know, self-sufficient, manages themselves. Out of a squad of sort of 33, there was probably three people, and I include myself in that in terms of my, you know, always going to see extra physio, extra trainers, nutrition, diet, you know, to sort of, you know, ability to look after my career, everything else. But not a lot of players could say they were like that. By the time he finished and got to the World Cup final, you know, there was probably 15 guys in there, 20 guys in there that were up to that level. And I think, you know, that's what's important, really. And I think that, you know, Stuart did the best job he could do, but it wasn't quite the right balance. And I think that he needed to, you know, leadership meetings with Eddie were about leadership, and we were like asking questions. You know, leadership under Stuart was telling us what he was going to say to the next group of people and not encouraging any input. But if you did fill input, it was, you know, not really that valued. And Eddie was like, he'd get you to speak and share, and everybody was involved. And he approached the game in a 360 degree angle instead of quite linear, you know?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely, I've always been a big fan of Eddie, and I actually think what Eddie does really well sometimes is he takes the pressure off of the team with the way he is with the media. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, like, 100%.
A bit like Phil Jackson did with the Bulls. I don't know if you've seen that documentary. Like, if you
I texted Eddie and I said to him, Eddie, you're the most like Phil Jackson of any rugby player any coach I've ever worked with.
Yeah. I mean, if I've read that. Have you ever read Phil Jackson's book?
I've just ordered it.
11 Rings, mate. It's honestly one of the best. It's best one of the best books on management I've ever read, and he's one of the best man managers of all time. He had to deal with two of the best individual basketball players ever. You know, you could argue Kobe Bryant and definitely Michael Jordan, and how he brought the best out of Michael Jordan by being able to get in his head and manage him correctly to work with the team. Like, Michael Jordan never won a championship by himself. Once he started working with Phil Jackson, that's when everything started to unlock.
Yeah, but do you know what the most astounding thing about Phil Jackson was? The balancing of characters and the ability to be themselves. You know, so for example, in rugby and in the rugby world, you know, I've always grown up against interpretations. Keep your head down. Don't, you know, only speak when spoken to. Don't do anything outside of rugby. Don't be flash. Don't do this. Very humble, whatever. Right. And coaches get panicked by mavericks or people who are individuals. So, you know, the likes of Cipriani, people find that working with him challenging. But, you know, he's a guy that has you know, a real X factor. And it's about managing him. Nice. Phil Jackson had Dennis Rodman, who's a complete mad fucker. Had Michael Jordan, who interesting about Michael Jordan, right, is that if you watch the thing, while his teammates were fond of him, not one of them ever said, Michael Jordan was a good lad. Michael Jordan was a top boy.
They feared him.
Yeah, Michael Jordan was like a great teammate. They all said Michael Jordan was the best at what he did. Michael Jordan drove the standards. Michael Jordan was the emotional heartbeat of the side. Michael Jordan made me a better player by pushing me, right? Yeah. So, but you need those kind of people. And then to have Scottie Pippen and to have the other guys, but make the other guys who weren't in the limelight feel as valued, but also do it with authenticity, but also... Yeah. You know, make people accountable when it's accountable. And Eddie is the closest to that I've ever experienced, because he wasn't shy of personalities. He wasn't intimidated by people. And I think that, you know, yes, I mean, Clive Woodward said it. There used to be people called energy sappers, right? If someone's a complete constant fuck up, so you're Dennis Rodman, right? Yes, he'd go off to Vegas, disappear. Yes, he'd go and do WWF wrestling or whatever it was. But actually, when he turn up, he front up, he do the fitness. If you're a bloke that fucks off, doesn't turn up for fitness, doesn't front up for cotton deck sessions, is always moaning and doesn't perform, you're an energy sapper, you're taking up too much time, clear you out, and there's somebody else who will do it. And that, for me, is Eddie's real skill.
Yeah, 100%. One thing I want to touch on before I ask you some pretty key questions. Lions, actually, kind of you've obviously been on a Lions tour. That's an interesting environment because as a coach, that must have been challenging because you only get people for a very small amount of time. So to be able to get that kind of like we just spoke about, to get that team to blend, what was that like in comparison to anything you've ever done going into a Lions tour, you know, with people from all countries, you know, you've only got a small amount of time and you're working to a very specific goal, which is only what, like 6-7 weeks down the line?
Yeah, so look, I firstly, you know, Warren Gatland, who I was very lucky to work with for a long time at WASP, is a master of of putting teams together after a short amount of time, getting them to gel, getting them to work. You know, with the Lions, so I had no expectations of what to expect. You know, being one of these people that, you know, when I walk into a room, you know, people have met me are going to think I'm a dick. You know, everybody that's ever come on House of Rugby says, before I met Joe Haskell, you know, I wanted to punch him in the face. I thought it was going to be a nightmare. You know, I thought this. And then I get to meet them and all of them unanimously turn around and say, actually, you know, good lad, hard working, blah, 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 funny. And I've seen people try not to laugh at my jokes and stuff because they're like, fuck, I hate this guy, but they can't help it. When you go into Lions, when you go to a Lions environment, there's a call up for, you know, in replacement, Billy Vunipola, who was probably, you know, one of the most informed number eights in the world at that time. You know, knowing that you weren't sort of first choice. Yeah, look, it was an amazing opportunity. I was nervous, but it was one of those things where I had the best experience of my life. I suddenly got to hang out with all these people that I played with and play against that I'd never got to spend any time with. We got to actually bond. And guys like Johnny Sexton, who I never thought I was going to get on with. He's an ultimate competitor on the field. I thought that he was going to be, you know, really difficult. Him and I got like a house on fire. Dan Bigger, same thing. Rory Best, didn't really know him, became friends for life. And I basically bonded with CJ Stander. And all these guys who, you know, my wife Chloe watches all, you know, all this stuff. But I watched Living with Lions. And apparently in Living with Lions, I haven't seen it, but the same thing happens. They're like, who was the person you least wanted to get on, you thought was going to get on with? James Haskell. Who was the person that you bonded with and was like the fun? James and they Haskell. Went, and they went, James Haskell. And interesting, when I came back with Eddie, I met up with him after that tour. He said to me, mate, every single person, every report I've come back with is that you made the midweek team, you know, in terms of entertainment. You know, you've done yourself proud and shown yourself to be a team man. And that's, right. You know, when you go on a tour like the Lions, you've got to understand, I was never going to start. I was disappointed. So I don't really call myself a Lion because I didn't get a test spot. But actually, you have a job to do on tours like that. You have to bring the entertainment. And if the midweek, or if the team bin juice, the midweek bin juice, go off the boil, they're miserable. That's what happened in 2005. You know, Clive Wood would split the two sides, test team, other team, never the twain shall meet. That midweek team got really toxic. It derails everything. You know, with Warren Gatland's tours, everyone plays a part. You play hard, you drink hard, you have fun, and you bond. And we're thrown in straight at the deep end. And mate, it's the best tour I've ever been on in my life.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, I can imagine. It must be an incredible experience. Really, really incredible. Right, okay. A couple of questions are very, very interesting. Best performance you think you've ever had in your career? As an individual, like, the one that stands out to me that I watched was that one in Australia. I mean, which for you was the standout performance across your career? On the rugby pitch, on the rugby pitch.
I think my personal one is actually when we played South Africa in 2014. The guys, Stuart Lancaster called me up. It was my first involvement. I was playing for the Highlanders. He invited me out to play. I basically turned up, worked out pretty quickly that he was just taking me out there to like put me in the midweek team. Probably wasn't going to play very much. And then Chris Robshaw broke his thumb and they started me at seven for the I've been playing seven for the Highlanders. And they put me at seven and I basically made 35 tackles, you know, and we got a draw. And I was probably my most physical I've ever been. It's the best tackling performance I've ever been. And for somebody that I didn't used to like tackling, I wasn't a massive fan of it. It's something I had to work really hard off. For me, it was my best performance. And someone like Paul Ackford, old former journalist, absolute penis, gave me fucking something like 5 out of 10 or 4 out of 10 for my performance and said, defensively, he drifted. I made 35 fucking tackles. Like, it was my best performance in an England shirt, I think, in terms of a team. We had absolutely no ball. And that for me was the best because we were against the ropes in South Africa, two tests down, you know, going to Port Elizabeth, mate. And I hadn't been in the England team, and it was massive. And then the best thing is after that performance, I got put into the Saxons. I got dropped. So yeah, no. But, mate, that's the story of my life really. But then Eddie came along, and all was well again.
All right, so who is the person? Okay, no, hold on, let's go for this one first. Who's the biggest character that you've come across in the game of rugby? Like, just overall, like, absolute character. Like, how do I define that? You know what I mean? Character, like, bloody good laugh, like, absolute loose cannon, like, just cracking.
I'm very lucky to have played with quite a few people. I say, you know, Lawrence is a very big character. You know, Joe Marler is a character in certain ways. You know, I'm trying to think who if there's anybody else that's like, ah, I mean, it's a hard one. I think someone like, you know, I think sort of, you know, like I said, like Lawrence, you know, was just, you know, a larger than life character. There's always stories. Phil Greening was a pretty mad, you know, madman back in the day. You know, I've had some pretty crazy guys. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else that, I would say those are Lawrence, Phil Greening, you know, Joe Marler, guys like that, I think.
Person that's had the biggest impact on your career? Coach, player, whoever. Could be.
I'm going to say coaches because I've worked with Warren Gatland, Sean Edwards, Jamie Joseph, Michael Checker, Eddie Jones, Di Young, and Ian McGee. Well, there's a few. So I would say, you know, Jamie Joseph, Michael Checker, Eddie Jones, Warren Gatland, Sean Edwards. You know, especially Sean and Warren in my early days. You know, Sean probably right up there. But those coaches wise, and my dad. You know, my dad always supporting me, always being there, and always helping me out.
Yeah, of course. Lovely. All right. Okay. So your career comes to an end. I actually remember bumping into you. I think it was actually the week that you announced it. Weirdly, I think I bumped into you and Chloe in Soho. Talk to us a little bit about that period. I mean, for a lot of all the autobiographies I've ever read, it's a bit of a strange time for professional athletes because being a professional athlete is kind of like your identity. How was that transition from, you know, leaving professional sport and then going on to the sort of next stage? Was it a difficult time for you?
Yeah, look, it was very difficult on a number of levels. I think, you know, emotionally, I wasn't finished playing rugby, you know, because from my knees upwards, I feel like I'm 21 again. You know, from my knees down, or my ankles, my toe, you know, I feel 40 years old. I can't walk down the stairs properly in the morning. I can't run anymore. So all these kind of things are quite difficult. I wanted to go to the World Cup. I went to Northampton for, you know, no money at all. To stay there and to play and to work with a brilliant team, which I absolutely loved. And I sort of regard myself much more as a Northampton Saint than I ever do a Wasp player because, you know, I only played five times for Saints, but I absolutely loved my time there. Just my body gave up. And it was a real shame because I put some good games in there, but just wasn't able to capitalise. And I wanted to go to Japan, finish off with Eddie and retire after that. Obviously, I couldn't do that, so I had to announce that. So you got all the disappointment of not playing for England again, disappointment of not playing rugby again. I have no skills in terms of, yes, I've taken products to market, business, and I'm a published author and everything else, but I don't have, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an accountant, I don't have any, you know, I didn't go to university. And it's like, what do you do? You know, all the stuff I want to do, DJing, public speaking, after dinner, TV presenting, you know, is all in someone else's hands, and I only ever worry about what I can control, and I can't control any of that. So it was very emotional. It was probably quite difficult for my wife to you know, to have that kind of emotion where I was going to finish what I was doing. I was probably not the easiest to get on with in that period of time. But actually, she gave me some really good advice. She said, "Listen, you know, it's what you've got to make sure you do is always do what you love. That's a surefire way of avoiding depression, avoiding everything else." And you know what? Her advice was brilliant. All I did was do all the stuff I love. We went traveling for the first time. I went to Japan with the House of Rugby. Eddie Jones invited me into the England camp for that last final week, thanked me in front of all the boys for the efforts I did, let me be a rugby player for one more day, watching training, having a coffee with the lads, doing a gym session. And it was like I put that ghost to rest of rugby because I walked out of there sad, emotional, sat in the taxi, sort of like, you know, just staring out the window in a rainy Japan. And that was it. And that was me done with England, done with everything. And it was kind of the perfect way for me to finish. They got to the final. I had a chance to go to the final. I didn't do it because I thought if they won, I wouldn't know what to do. If they lost, I wouldn't know what to do. So I stayed in a bar right next to the stadium when we recorded House of Rugby, and I stayed with Chloe, and she sort of was there with me. And I was really disappointed for the lads that they didn't get to win it. But that was it. And now I'm sort of the other side of it. Now I'm in a really weird position where I don't ever feel like I play rugby. That's the weirdest thing. I don't remember a lot of it. I don't feel like I was a rugby player. I feel I've got more life to live on the other side of being a rugby player than I do without it. I am struggling sometimes for an identity as to what I'm doing, you know, because the fighting stuff stopped because of injury, because of lockdown. No one's getting DJing stuff. No one's doing any public speaking. You know, the exciting thing is my book's coming out. I'm recording, you know, I've recorded about 50 podcasts during this lockdown, House of Rugby, and for loads of other people. So I get to chat a lot of shit, but I, you know, it's sort of also, you know, direction really. I'm a bit rudderless at the moment.
I mean, it's I was about to say, man, like, you are probably, I think you're the busiest person I know, man. You're like, you've got, obviously, I was going to talk about your book, What a Flanker. When is that being launched, firstly? And, like, you know, I'm buzzing to, well, it hasn't launched yet. Has it actually come out? The physical copies?
It's not out. No. So, it's available on, so basically, we did 1,000 copies signed for Waterstones. That went in an hour. So, we did another 1,000, that went. And we've done another 1,000 and that's gone. So then we've got, so then we're launching on October the 1st. I'm doing a podcast around the show. I can't say too much about it. So we're going to interview some cool people talking about different things. And it comes out 1st of October in hardback. And then hopefully we'll do a book tour. I think it's going to cause a few headlines, if I'm completely honest with you. And I haven't been controversial for the sake of being controversial. I haven't tried to throw anyone under the bus for saying, you know, under the bus. All I've done is been really honest. It's not like a normal autobiography. It's not, I played these people and we lost here and this is what the build-up before this game. It's a collection of short stories, a collection of all the humour, the characters, the excitement. You know, it's not any autobiography, like any autobiography you've ever read, really.
That's awesome. I can't wait to read that. And obviously, you're on the MMA scene still, like, obviously I understand that. Sorry, my WhatsApp's going off. Go away, WhatsApp. MMA, how did you get into that, and what's the end goal with it? Like, have you got that fight just been delayed a bit? What's the vibe, and how's the training? Is it you loving it?
So look, you know, firstly, I was very lucky to work with shoot fighters and get an opportunity with Bellator in the first place. You know, look, I was doing it 6 days a week. I was driving, I was 4 hours in the car every day, going down there, training 2.5 hours. I was living that professional lifestyle again for 5 months. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. It was incredibly physically draining, emotionally draining, you know, enjoyable and fucking hard to, you know, I was sparring, heavy sparring kind of twice a week, sparring every day, wrestling and jiu-jitsu. And look, I enjoyed it. I was ready to go for the 12th of May. I tore my pec just before I went in to the thing, which is horrific. I've now got a dent. I don't know if you can see, I've got a hole where my pec used to be. Oh, wow. It's like goes in, which is a bit weird. And so I rehabbed that, and it's still a bit soreness. I would have made the fight. They've postponed the fight. I honestly don't know. You know, the thing is, with being ruthless, I haven't earned any money during this lockdown period. You know, committing 5-6 days a week to fighting is a hard call, you know, to fight in an empty arena. So I don't know. I mean, you know, I've got some medical issues as well that I need to look into. So I don't know. It's a bit up in the air at the moment. I gave everything I could do, ready to go for it. I've got to review my position on it and just see what the story is, because, you know, Bellator's not about fighting. Nobody's fighting. The world's uncertain and we don't know what's going to happen yet. So we'll have to watch this space. But I liked it and I actually got okay at it. And, you know, I found out I'm not a pussy, because, you know, there's always that fear that you get stuck in a cage with someone and you start taking punches. Can you take a punch? Can you do that? And you know, trust me, I took a fair few punches in my time.
First, last two questions. And but I just want to say thanks so much for coming on, man. I've really enjoyed this. It's been an absolute banger. Like, people are going to love it. I always ask these last two questions. Firstly, if you had one life lesson that you've learned along the way to pass on, if you could pick one, what would that be? Just something that really stands out.
I'd merge two things, right, which is along a similar line. So firstly, you can lie to everyone else, but you can't lie to yourself, is a great example of something that really governs what you do. So, for example, you work in the health and fitness business, you work changing people. You know, everybody in the world wants to blame everybody else for doing stuff. That, you know, I my boyfriend left me, so I had to eat all this food. My wife left me, so I went on the piss with the lads. Oh, I couldn't do that training because the kids were doing my head in. I didn't track my food because I couldn't do this. Oh, the scales have gone up. You know, if the answer to any of the questions is, did you not train hard enough? Did you not track your food? Did you? And it's all in your control. You're the one to fucking blame. And you can tell everybody else, if you hate your job and you aren't successful at it and your bosses don't like you, it's not because you don't like you. Why don't they like you? Well, have you put the extra effort in? Have you been to work? Do you turn up on time? Do you work on the weekends? Do you produce good content? If the answer to any of those questions is no, it's your own fucking fault. And we live in a world of pointing fingers at other people. I think the next bit to help you with that is only worry about things you can control. Easier said than done. I understand that. But there's three things in life you can control. Your body and your mind, how you look after yourself, how you treat other people and how you hard you work. Everything else you don't own. You have no control. So every time you're sitting in lockdown, freaking out about not doing stuff, is when's lockdown going to end? You don't control it. Don't worry about it. When's am I going to get back? I'd like to buy this boat. How are you going to buy this boat? Well, I can't. All I can worry about is how hard I work. How do I develop my mind? Do I develop my body? And all those little things can be broken down into little facets of that. And those for me are the really important life lessons. If you follow them, you will not go wrong.
Beautiful. Love it. Love it, love it, love it. And lastly, before I leave you in peace, where can people find you? Where can people find the book? Any extra information on you? I'll stick it all in the show notes so everyone can see. I can't wait to read that book, so everybody else will be keen too. So let us know.
Okay, so if you want to give me a follow, I'm on Instagram under @JamesHaskell. That's where I spend a lot of my time. I'm on my Facebook page, James Haskell, again, JHHF. It's like a fan page thing. I've got a YouTube channel under, again, James Haskell. And my radio show is called Back Row Radio. It's available on Mixcloud and iTunes. It's a house music show. Great for training, great for sort of home workouts, great for parties, whatever you want. My book, What a Flanker, is out October the 1st. It's available through Amazon pre-order now. It's also available through Waterstones. And I've got a podcast called House of Rugby, which is coming very well, which is going to be, we finished season 2, but some more exciting stuff's coming. But listen to the back catalogue, and that's about it, really.
You, mate, thank you so much. Awesome to have you on. Absolute pleasure. Hope to see you soon in some capacity. And yeah, all the best through the rest of this COVID period.
Thanks, mate. Good luck to you boys, and thanks for having me on.